Well, thanks, Bob. And it's really great to be here. And actually, at my age, it's really great to be anywhere. I'd like to talk about booms, busts, and challenges of low-diversity ecosystems. And I think part of that is making this thing work. Okay, there we go. Setting the stage, first of all. And, okay, you know, look at it outside. It's not exactly summertime. I thought I'd take us all to the Coral Triangle, where centered around the Philippines, we have the highest biodiversity of marine life anywhere. And if we all went to Palau, what we would see is a remarkably diverse system with lots of species, no single dominant. We might want to turn the lights down. It might improve the... But in 1998, it suffered a massive bleaching event, and I came by 2 years later looking at a lot of coral recruitment and the corallines, and 7 years later, we were looking at significant recovery, and this is a photograph I took in March. And the system has recovered its biodiversity almost fully. This is what a resilient system can do. We don't have any significant hyperdominances of any single species. And it's really speaking to this idea that we're looking at a world that has an incredible gradient of diversity. The example I just gave you is for Palau. If you take quadrat after quadrat and you look at the number of species, just species richness, what you find is a steeply ascending and continuously ascending curve of very high diversity. If you did the same thing in the Caribbean, you'd find something in the middle, and where I come from, the Gulf of Maine, comes in dead last. Now, the reason is because, let's think about the North Atlantic. It's the world's smallest ocean, youngest ocean, certainly in terms of its cold water environment. It's been incompletely inoculated primarily from the North Pacific, and so we have a subset of North Pacific parent stock, and then every roughly 120,000 years, we get these pesky glaciers coming down and sitting over a lot of habitat. On top of that, for the North Atlantic, the Western North Atlantic is particularly low diversity. And if we look at some of Frank's work, where you just simply look at species richness along this gradient of where we are, we see a pattern like this, declining diversity as we move to the north. So the Gulf of Maine, where I come from, gives us a sign that looks something like this, if I can get this thing to work, yes. And Newfoundland is here, and of course Labrador just above it. So we're talking about really low diversity. This is fish. And what we have is then, if you look at a global pattern of the world with the warmer colors being more productive, we are in an area of the world that has high productivity but low biodiversity. And one could compare that to tropical areas that have low productivity and high biodiversity. The bottom line is, if you're interested in things like fisheries, it's great that you've got the horsepower for high productivity. And so what I'd like to talk about today is this big picture, thinking about the North Atlantic and Gulf of Maine, where I've been doing my work, asking the question, what was natural and what is healthy? Thinking about shifting baselines, the importance of local ecological interactions. Our future, the growing risks, approaching tipping points and surprises, the booms and busts that I'm talking about. And some ideas for the future, how we can improve our responsiveness and perception of these problems. And then I'm not going to answer this, but this is something I hope we all can talk about, and that is, what can we do and what will we do? And those are actually two separate questions. So the cast of characters, when I came as a professor at the University of Maine, I was seeing a world like this with a narrow kelp fringe, a good number of sea urchins, kind of the wildebeests of the area, and lobsters and crabs. What I didn't ask is this natural? And I didn't ask, is this healthy? Lobster landings throughout the western North Atlantic, this includes Canada and the U.S., has been showing a remarkable increase. That's continued to today. But a good question is this natural? Is it healthy? Now, if we could ask the first people who were, like, camping out on the coast of the Gulf of Maine what was natural? What would they say? What kind of environment was there before humans had a big effect? Well, we can't quite do that, but what we can do is we can look at an archaeological site. This is in the central coast of Maine, and it's called the Turner Farm. It's the best excavated site that we have in the state of Maine. I've done a lot of work on it, and what we find, in fact, are fish hooks that were carved out of deer bone that carbon date to 5,000 years ago. This is a cod vertebra that's 4,000 years old, and that's a centimeter scale that it's resting on. So it's huge, much bigger than a human vertebra. And so we see that there's a player. There was a player in coastal Maine. If you look at all of the bone fragments from 400 years ago to 4,500 years ago, we find, number one, are cod bones. And there's also a significant number of flounder. There's the extinct sea mink. There are interesting, you know, there's a couple of sea urchins, odd things like great white sharks. But what's not in these middens, and as far as I know, not in any of the archaeological sites, any place in the Western North Atlantic, there's no evidence of lobsters or crabs. And I don't think it's a preservational problem, because in a lot of other archaeological sites, California and Alaska, for example, crabs preserve readily. Lobsters fossilize. So why don't we see these? And one of the reasons may be is because we had this not only abundant but also large cod. When we reconstructed their size, we're finding that the average size of cod that was being harvested for thousands of years were averaging about a meter in length. And that's very big by Maine standards. This most recent decline is the part I call Honey, I Shrunk the Cod. Well, the very first fishery scientists working in the coast of Maine mapped the fishing grounds. And this is the map that Good created in the 1800s from the 1830s. And he has these little areas that were good fishing grounds. But then in the center, you see over to the left, around what was then called the Fox Islands and Isle of Ho, no identified fishing grounds. 100 years later, a guy named Rich did the same study. And so these are really either the good fishing grounds described by Rich or the rich fishing grounds described by Good. It goes either way. But still, nothing is being found in the central area. And then Ted Ames, he interviewed a bunch of old fishermen, and they talked about the fishing in the 1930s, 1940s. And the areas that they described were not these rich fishing grounds that were earlier described, but these areas that were not being found in the earlier maps was where the fishing grounds were described, and they were, in fact, spawning aggregation sites. Now, apparently the spawning aggregation areas were known, but they weren't fished for a long time because spawn cod apparently rots until they had the technology of mechanized vessels and refrigeration. And with that, in relatively short order, those spawning aggregations started to disappear. Now, the question might be, were those aggregations local stocks? Rather than thinking about cod as a, you know, particles randomly distributed in space and time, were they actually individual stocks that had their own spawning grounds and their own feeding grounds? And there's lots of really good evidence, mostly by Canadian researchers, suggesting that there's good genetically distinct stocks distributed around. There's also research showing that they even just simply look different. So this is actually something that's been very hard to convince the fisheries managers in the United States is real, but I'm pretty convinced it is real. And might the local stocks result from these local spawning aggregations, and could they contribute to local demographic persistence? And why I'm stressing local is that it's starting to define the scale over which we should be addressing these problems, the scale over which we may actually get some traction. So let's look at some of the patterns. This is what the spawning sites looked like from Ted Ames' work based on the 1930s fishermen. And one of the things that you see is that these distinct spawning aggregations, I'm having modest success with my remote here. Okay. There are two places described today as active spawning aggregation sites in the United States. And... Here we go. And what's really interesting is that there's another one up in the mouth of the Bay of Fundy, and someone sent me this very interesting publication, Local Knowledge and Local Stocks, an atlas of groundfish spawning in the Bay of Fundy. And what's cool about that is that there, I had never seen this before, but apparently there are these sites, including right in the mouth of the Bay of Fundy. And when you superimpose that, what you end up seeing is we have spawning sites in the United States and this site in the Bay of Fundy. And if you think about the distribution of cod, this is the aggregate, 1968 to 2003. Hold on, folks. I think I'm wearing out the remote. Consider the change over the past 30 years. This is the 1970s, and we see essentially like a donut around the Gulf of Maine. This is the 1980s. And notice that you're starting to see sets developing. This is the 1990s and the 2000s. And what I think is not a coincidence is that we're seeing the remnant stocks around the extant spawning aggregations. And what you don't see, in fact, are this. We see these big area of extirpated spawning sites that remain cod depleted today. And it's not just cod. It's a whole series of groundfish. So perhaps the loss of the spawning aggregations is a local tipping point. It's a reproductive one. And the consequences of this creating a predator-free zone is something worth pursuing, because back at the turn of the last century, cod were considered to be the most destructive enemy of the lobster. And so I got into looking at this, and this is some footage that I took using an ultra-low-light camera at night, and I did it 24 hours a day, and I did it for 4 years. We tethered a lot of lobsters, and it's very boring, except occasionally a small cunner would come by and never saw himself on television before, not sure what his best side is. But in the background, in fact, all of the lobsters are doing just fine. And out at Cassius Ledge, 80 miles offshore, in the 1980s, I was doing some submarine work, and we found out there a very impressive relic population of large predatory finfish. So I set up, this is a tethered lobster on a patio block. The yellow video camera. Most of what you see there are pollock, but there's also cod and wolffish and cunner and cusk, some very good sized individuals. This is an area that at the time there wasn't any rock hopping gear, and there was a really good local population. And we were getting about 75% of all of the lobsters that we harvested consumed on a daily basis. And as a matter of fact, we ended up losing 5 of those patio blocks. So in the data that we published, in terms of fish visitation rate and body size, they were small on the coast and very rare. And what we saw was the attack rates of the small, medium, and large lobsters. The attack rates were concentrated really just on the small lobsters, whereas offshore, where we were looking at these abundant predators, we were seeing all the size classes were being eaten, with the largest one being the largest lobsters were being eaten at the highest rate. So it's almost like optimal foraging. They're taking the big guys. So what we end up having is what we call a trophic cascade. You've got apex predators. They're carnivores. The carnivores keep their prey in check, and that includes sea urchins, lobsters, and crabs. And as a matter of fact, the herbivore, being the only herbivore in our system that really matters, it actually, being rare, would have meant that the pristine state would have been carnivores and seaweed driven. You know, mostly that would be the most abundant components. So what we're looking at today are big fish are ecologically extinct. And the implications of being a baby lobster in a world dominated by tiny fish is daunting. These are the same size patio blocks the wolffish are dragging away. These little spots are fourth stage lobsters who had just settled to the benthos that we tethered using monofilament and super glue. And what we found was the attack rates were monumental. We were getting they were measured in minutes in terms of how long they would survive. And so what we end up seeing and concluding from all this is that if you look at the attack rates today, and it's a function of body size along the x-axis, the attack rate's really high when they are just settling. They find themselves into cobblestone habitats where they're relatively safe. They suspension feed for a couple of years. And by the time they get out and start foraging after 2 years, they're immune to predators because there aren't any big mouths out there. Offshore, and what may have been the case in the past, was lobsters would have been vulnerable to predators for over 10 years. And one could argue that's why they were so rare in middens today. But what we've seen is overfishing of these apex predators. Prey species have been able to explode. And among those were the sea urchins that increased in great abundance, creating sea urchin barrens, having the beloved corallines of Bob Hooper and myself being the dominant of the community. But I think that this area that is basically a predator-free zone today creates an entirely different dynamic for lobsters. I spent 10 years studying the settlement of larval lobsters, and this is the settlement hotspot where most of the larvae were settling. In a world without predators, that translates to the number of adult lobsters you see, and when you look at total population densities, they peak where settlement is high. We call this settlement-driven demography, and the population densities are huge, large areas with up to 2 per meter squared. That's the highest lobster population density in the world. Well, that's interesting, and that's actually shaping an awful lot of what we're seeing. The pictures that I showed early on of our abundance is probably to a large degree due to this absence of predators. And so what we see is an ecosystem that has changed in favor of the lobsters, things that had evolved under this kind of predation. And we see this kind of overfishing that results in this kind of hyper-densities of prey. When you see things that were formerly abundant that are rare, things that were formerly rare, like arguably lobsters that are now hyper-abundant, these are, I think, indications of instabilities and serious problems in this ecosystem. And the sea urchin, in fact, was part of this story because in areas where there are cod, you didn't see much in the way of sea urchins. And what we saw was sea urchins increasing along coastal Maine, peaking roughly in the 1980s. And they would form these unbelievable carpets in some places where they're primarily living on drift algae. But this was too much of a resource to be left unchecked. And in 1987, a sea urchin fishery began. It became second only to lobsters in terms of value. And this is a classic boom and then a bust. We got rid of urchins the old-fashioned way. We overfished them. And I wanted to look at, well, what are the impacts of that? And so I was tethering little kelp strips on the seafloor and looking at the rates at which they get eaten. And I can tell you that animal rights people are much more comfortable with me tethering kelp strips than tethering lobsters. And what we found was, in fact, that the consumption rates before the urchin industry began were huge. But after 1987, we found this population of urchins were dwindling, consumption rates were declining, so the fishing was actually affecting the process of herbivory. And that contributed to the explosion of kelp. And this is some footage that I took in 1993 at one of my favorite sites at Pemaquid. I've got a mooring there, and it was just sea urchins and corallines. This is what the world looked like. And literally, 2 years later, from exactly the same location, this is what it looked like. And as a matter of fact, it has not reverted back. So it's been a very long-term change that results, I think, an alternate stable state, with the sea urchin fishery on a 50-year cycle being this one pulse, the sea urchin abundance, which rose and then crashed with this, resulted in this phase shift into fleshy macroalgae. And so what we see is what I call trophic level dysfunction happening at really two levels, leaving us with an algal community that's dominated today and has remained. As a matter of fact, this this scenario of alternating between having been kelp to being urchin dominated and then seeing this phase shift due to the sea urchin fishing, this is interesting, but it's even more interesting that after fishing stopped, the urchins did not recover. It's an alternate stable state. And exactly why that's happening is not because there aren't larvae, because in the area of the greatest decline that happened early, we're getting between 5,000 and 15,000 sea urchin larvae per meter square per year. None of them are living to be 1 year old. High post-settlement mortality because we have a carpet of seaweed, and that carpet of seaweed, in fact, is a great habitat for crabs. It's a shag carpet, which frankly is not a word I should use when I'm talking to BBC, but a bushy algae that increases the recruitment potential of the benthos for crabs that otherwise were raining down in high numbers, but when they're sitting on coral and algae, they're getting picked off by radiated shanties and little small fish that are commercially unimportant. But in this cover, we were getting huge densities of crabs. We were seeing 200 per meter square. And in fact, with our studies, we were able to find that they were eating the sea urchins that were settling. And so micropredators were actually stopping the urchins from landing and surviving. So the macroalgae regulates the recruitment potential of the benthos for crabs. It makes it a good nursery habitat. The crabs regulate the recruitment potential for the urchins, making it a hostile habitat. And the question then is, okay, well, does that have demographic importance? If you look at the crabs that are settling, Cancer borealis, 1975 to 1995, National Marine Fisheries Service trawl data for the entire Gulf of Maine had a relatively low density. After we had the phase shift to macroalgae along the coast of Maine, we saw an entirely new world in terms of the density of crabs. So we set up to do an experiment, and the experiment was to bring a bunch of sea urchins to these underwater islands, 3,000 urchins per plot. They should graze everything back down to corallines. The urchins should be able to settle. But what we did not realize is that those micro-predator crabs grow up to be macro-predator crabs with an attitude. And what we saw was there were something on the order of 3,000 sea urchins, sorry, per plot. And they held that density for several months until the crab population moved in. They're migratory, and they moved in August. They ate all the urchins, and after the urchins collapsed, they left. So what we see is a really interesting world where sea urchins fishing reached a tipping point, flipped the system. The decline was rapid and persistent. Herbivory declined. Algal biomass increased. Recruitment potential for crabs increased. The recruitment potential for urchins declined. And then the predation potential increased because adult crabs became the new apex predator. These kind of ecological interactions happening locally are reinforcing feedbacks that lock the system and make it persistent. And this is the kind of local ecological study that I think we might be able to get a handle on to get an idea about what's driving the system. But the fact is, these kind of changes are a total surprise. I never would have predicted in a million years that big crabs were going to dominate the coast of Maine. Now, why hasn't this happened before? Well, it hasn't happened before to a large degree because, as Smith points out in his paper from 1897, when they wanted to get crabs, they would simply go and catch fish in Casco Bay, and this happens to be cod ledges right where we did this experiment. They would find these crabs inside the stomach of the cod. So it's a different world. The predation has fundamentally changed this predator-free zone. And the world that we see today is fundamentally altered. We're not seeing sea urchins. We are seeing a lot of large decapods, and we're seeing a fair amount of algae. And the ultimate recipient of all of this is that we have managed the system towards lobsters. And this gets us back to the fragility of low diversity. Because if you think about this, we're dealing with such a simple system that we basically have something more like a food chain. And if you lose individual groups in this food chain, you can destabilize the system. Now, arguably, if you have a more diverse system, losing a species doesn't destabilize the system. One could argue that as we continue to fish down food webs, we are turning more food webs into food chains. And from that perspective, I think what we're seeing here in Newfoundland and what we're seeing in the Gulf of Maine may well be a bellwether for what we're seeing throughout the world as we continue to fish down stocks globally. So the increased chances of booms and busts increase as we start seeing the simplification of these food webs. And but ultimately, it's the economics that everybody tends to react to. And from that perspective, as long as the marine resources are valuable, and arguably in Maine they're getting more valuable, even when you correct for inflation, then everybody wins. At least that's what some people say. In the 1920s, we were getting 1 out of 10 species of harvested stocks were an invertebrate, but actually the value, even corrected for inflation, was less than the value is today. But now, in 2004, 80%, and right now it's about 85% of Maine's value comes from a single species. And today, bloodworms are worth more than cod in this coast of Maine. And ironically, bloodworms are used for bait. So in terms of thinking about this, a lot of people have a Pollyanna view that, you know, well, the lobsters are valuable, so this is a success story. And I think actually it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think the bigger socioeconomic picture needs to be considered. And it's what I call the gilded trap. And that is, we've done all the right things. Lobsters are hugely abundant, but we've managed towards a monoculture. And the monoculture puts us at risk. If you want to see how this is illustrated, this is the value of marine resources, of all the things that we have data for the state of Maine. Lobsters, number one, from 1950 on. Then we had the opening of the EEZ and globalized markets. And when we did that, in fact, we saw the diversity go up. And that's an impressive sight. But if you look at the economic diversity of fisheries in Maine, and the black line is using a Shannon index for diversity, and the blue line is actually the percent that's lobsters. And from 1950 to 1970s, it's pretty much running parallel. Then you have the opening of the EEZ in 1977, and you see the diversity going way up. This is economic diversity, okay? And then you've seen this crash. And what we see is this rise of what we call this lobsters is basically our lucrative monoculture. Now, feeding this lucrative monoculture is herring as bait. And if you look at the tonnage of landings in Maine for lobsters and for herring, what you end up seeing is that herring has been declining in its landings as lobsters have been increasing. As a matter of fact, we're harvesting a greater tonnage of lobsters than herring. And at the same time, herring is increasing in value. And what we end up with is increasing dependency of lobster bait at ever-increasing cost. And, you know, it basically is a bait for the gilded trap. There's no safety net. And bait is being imported to Maine from as far away as New Zealand just for the lobster fishery. Now, this is kind of a crazy situation to be in. And as far as the eye can see in Maine today, we don't even have seasons. We fish, you know, 12 months out of the year. You've got 7,000 lobstermen depending upon this one species. It's 85% of the value. One could argue it's a socioeconomic time bomb. Now, it's not an idle concern because in Long Island Sound, the population densities were going up wonderfully to 1998. It was the warmest year on the planet. One could argue that there was a lot of stresses involved, and I think you're going to be hearing about that in the next talk. But a shell disease broke out. It was a massive shell disease problem, and 80% of the lobsters declined. They have not recovered. It's another a boom and a bust and an alternative stable state, which is now largely lobster-free. So in Maine, if populations crash, how long before the coastal villages would be lost to wealthy people eager to live on the coast of Maine? Call this gentrification. And even if the lobster stocks recovered, there'd be little chance of the coastal communities could return. It's kind of a social alternative stable state that would be created. So we need to avoid this kind of gilded trap, and we need to diversify our fisheries And we need to think about how we reinvent fishing. And I think from that perspective, I think there's a lot of logic in leveling the playing field, sharing science and comparing observations with the fishing community. And this is something that I've been doing for a long time. There was a recent special issue of Commercial Fisheries News talking about the 50 years anniversary of the Maine Lobsterman's Association, and they actually credited me as one of the first scientists to actually work closely with them. And, oh, this is interesting. How do I do this? Hold on. So this is, you know, just basically being able to talk to the fishing fishermen, going out fishing with them. I took them with me on some of my lobster submarine adventures. And we were able to look at the resource really simultaneously, discussing it and thinking about what might be going on. It was a very good way to create long-term friendship and also understanding of each other's perspective on this resource. I wrote a paper about the Gilded Trap. The New York Times found that interesting. They made a big deal about it. It was on local radio. And the Maine Lobsterman's Association newsletter actually wrote an article about the Gilded Trap. Now, this is profoundly bad news for the lobster industry. And what I found really interesting is that to this day, I haven't had or heard of any angry responses from the lobstermen. Creative ones, interesting ones, but not angry ones. And I think that what this says is that it's not just that the fishing community wants to hear the stuff that that they want to hear. If they trust the source, I think that that communication will work. And along those lines, I think the best approach that we could take is one where we start getting sort of a network of information, knowledge, fishermen's knowledge, to the managers, good lines of communication between the scientific community as well as the fishing community. I think academics and students can help with this. And with this, I think as a way forward, we can form a durable network of local local adaptive management. And it could be applied very locally, working at local fishing villages and networking that from the bottom up. And I think we have to remember as we move forward that we have to expect the unexpected. I mean, for example, how infrequently this remote works is unexpected to me. And the surprises will continue, and fisheries management must evolve agility. And I say that because, and you're going to hear a lot more about this in the next talk, but climate change is a very big issue, obviously. And if you look at the projected thermal anomalies, you'll see that this area of the world is projected to have a very major thermal anomaly. We're already seeing temperatures rise, and we're already seeing northern shifts of some species. The projections are even to go higher than that. We're talking about 4 to 6 to possibly 8 degrees in the Gulf of Maine. And Ken Drinkwater published a paper suggesting the modest increase of 4 degrees and what that would mean for cod. And the line that you would draw if there is a 1 degree change is like that, a 2 degree change is like that, a 3 degree change. But this 4 degree, which is not an outrageous increase, cod basically will be absent. We cannot live in the Gulf of Maine. And so we have to think about a new world. And this summer, working with lobstermen, we're seeing a lot of black sea bass, which are typical in the mid-Atlantic states in the Gulf of Maine. These kind of shifts of warm water species are found all over the place. And I think that means we're going to have to look locally. We're going to have to be able to assess the problem locally. And I've been this summer working with, in the last 3 years, with fishermen to develop local assessment methods, low-cost ROVs, conducting substrate and depth-specific work, spatially explicit multi-species assessments, which are near real time. And just to show you what we can get from this, you know, not to glaze your eyeballs, but just one, for instance, is that we see shrimp over the sediment. We see Acadia redfish over the rock. really remarkable substrate segregations. We're seeing depth patterns, coastal zones dominated by lobsters and cunner. The fact is we can get population densities this way. It's non-destructive. Working with the fishing community, they get to see what we're doing, and they get to contribute. And I think that this is possibly a good way forward. So in terms of my suggestions and conclusions, low-diversity ecosystems such as ours are prone to booms and busts. I hope I've given you a couple of examples of a few of those. Ecosystems and social systems can flip and lock into an alternative stable state. Local ecological patterns and processes are important, and I think we need to come up with ways of doing that, assessing those things. However, expect the unexpected, especially as we consider climate change in the future. This will require local problem solving, local responses at smaller scales, in my view. Scaling up requires effective multi-scale governance. I think a lot of people in the room are interested in that. And we need all of those things to deal with the booms and busts and challenges of low diversity, ecological, and social systems. And with that, I thank you all.